You're now listening to the Engage the Rockies podcast, your go-to podcast for local and state issues concerning Colorado.
Hello, Colorado. This is Engage the Rockies podcast. I am your host, Jarvis Caldwell, Executive Director of Engage the Rockies. And today we have a very special episode. We're talking about El Paso County Government's Pikes Peak Promise. What is it? Who is involved? What are the issues that they're looking to address? And our special guest today is Ryan Parcell. Ryan is the Government Affairs Executive Director for El Paso County, Colorado Government. Ryan, thank you for joining us here today.
Jarvis, thanks for having me on today.
Thank you very much. And so if you're listening to this and you say, well, I don't live in El Paso County, so maybe I'm not too concerned with this episode. This is an important episode because of the topics we're going to cover. They really are issues that I think apply all across the state of Colorado. And this may be something that you may be interested in bringing to your local county or city governments and issues that they need to address as well. So please stay tuned with us here, and we're going to dive right into it. So Pikes Peak Promise. Ryan, what is it? Can you explain it to us and give us a 30,000-foot overview of it?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
And thanks again, Jarvis. Yeah, so you know, I'm a big context person. So to answer a question like that, I got to kind of set the stage a little bit, if you'll permit me.
Great.
So, you know, El Paso County, we've had a government affairs team for some time, and we work in the public policy arena because we're a political subdivision of the state. And so, you know, a county commissioner and the countywide elected officials, they have the ability to set certain policies and agendas and everything else. But for the most part, that's driven by policy set by the state. And so it doesn't matter what a commissioner feels about certain issues. You know, we still have to follow the state formula for administering the Department of Human Services or something like that. And so we stood up our policy shop because we have a vested interest in the policies that the state will have us implement for our citizens. And so as we were looking at that, we noticed a couple of things when it comes to the state legislature. And that is that the legislature is a group of, I think, well-intentioned people who are trying to solve problems for the state, but they don't always understand the impacts of those policies on a local level. And I think that that people in different sectors would see something similar. So if you really care strongly about education policy, you might see examples of that. If you care about environmental policy, you might see some examples of that. And so one day after one of the sessions, when we were celebrating the close of the session and all the work that we'd engaged in, we started to think about how different organizations work with the legislature. And a lot of times, whether it's a good policy or a policy that has some unintended consequences, we notice that different entities out there might view a proposal like, oh, wow, well, that really impacts us in a good way, but somebody else wasn't impacted positively or left out or something like that.
Right.
Or maybe this impacts us in a negative way, but somebody else was impacted more. And at least regionally, there just wasn't a lot of collaboration in trying to set common policies that entities and organizations across the board could get behind that would positively impact all of El Paso County. And so that's what we set out to do with the Pikes Peak Promise, was to build a framework for legislative priorities that would benefit all the citizens of El Paso County, even if it wasn't just in one particular entity's lane.
Yeah, that's a great overview and explanation of that, and I appreciate that. So when you talk about the county bringing different agencies and entities together, can you kind of expand on that a little bit? Like who in El Paso County, different government agencies are involved in the Pikes Peak Promise?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we set out to do this, we thought, who are the people that have the biggest impact on the day-to-day lives of the average citizen in El Paso County? Of course, law enforcement, public safety is a big one. And right. So we wanted to work with the district attorney's office as well as the sheriff's office.
Yeah.
City government is a big one. Most mm-hmm. people in El Paso County actually live in the city of Colorado Springs. So we mm-hmm. wanted some representation from the city. Economic issues are a big one. So we wanted to go with the chamber. Right. And then education. You know, most people have children in the education system. Almost everybody's come through the education system. So everybody's right. interacted right. With public education one way or another. So that was another big one. So when we got together in mm-hmm. these little groups and these buckets, we were looking at policies that we thought would impact the greatest amount of people in the region mm-hmm. in those different buckets and formulated ideas from there. And the result from that was a set of policy parameters that mm-hmm. we've ascribed the name of the organizations that participated and some of the other entities. We've invited them to formally join on by resolution or whatever their process is
right.
to help us push for these common goals.
Excellent. Now, and I probably should have clarified this in the beginning. So the Pikes Peak Promise, this was rolled out, correct me if I'm wrong, was it maybe October, November of 2023?
You're right, October.
Okay,
absolutely.
It's October 2023. Okay, excellent. And so you had mentioned involving the city as well, because obviously most of the population that live in El Paso County live in Colorado Springs. Now, is that, just for clarification for the listeners, is that, was it city council? Was it the mayor's office? Was it the local police department? Who exactly, like, from the city is involved in that?
Yeah, great question. We'd reached out to a couple members of city council because while this was rolled out in October of 23, mm-hmm. it actually started a bit earlier in 23. And in between, as your savvy listeners, I'm sure, are well aware, there's mayoral election.
Right.
And so, you know, do you work with the outgoing administration or the new incoming administration? And sometimes a new elected official needs a little bit of time to figure out which priorities right. they want to pursue.
Absolutely.
So we've had conversations with the mayor's office and look forward to continuing those conversations in the future.
Absolutely. Good to hear. So we're just going to cover priorities, big picture priorities. You already mentioned it, just a refresh for listeners. So it's public safety, unlocking opportunity, cost of living are the three main topics here. And then, so on your press release on the El Paso County government's website, they break down like a list under each one of those three top priorities, and they have pretty specific issues that they want to address on here. And so we'll just go ahead and start at the top with public safety. So for those who are unfamiliar, one of the priorities is removing the $25,000 personal liability and restoring qualified immunity. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this is applying directly to law enforcement officers. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I appreciate you bringing that mm-hmm. one up right out the gate, because this is one of those instances where I think the legislature is trying to deal with a very complex topic in law enforcement accountability. And for those who may not know, qualified immunity is a doctrine that helps protect actually all government workers as long as they're, for lack of a better term, trying to do the normal aspects of their job. Right. Now, in some instances, in examples where the police have overstepped their authority, qualified immunity has turned into something of a scapegoat in police accountability, at least in the interpretation of a lot of folks that feel strongly about that issue. And mm-hmm. so the legislature passed Senate Bill 2217, which was seeking to tweak qualified immunity as a legal protection for peace officers. but right. it had a detrimental impact on the ability to recruit and mm-hmm. retain the sort of peace officers that you want to have on the streets. Because when you increase the liability and make it personal liability for an individual officer, that makes people pause and think if that's the profession for them, if they're supported by the community in a way that makes their service feel valuable. So we think for the sake of being able to attract and retain sort of officers that we need, you know, that have the right temperament to serve justice well, that's an important protection to have. And our stance has been that there are already ways on the books in mm-hmm. Colorado to insert accountability when an officer extends beyond their legal authority.
Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing up Senate Bill 217. And if I read correctly before when I was preparing for this, so Senate Bill 217, that was a 2020 bill that was passed in the legislature, and I don't know if this was a bill already written, and then it was just coincidental, but I know it was signed not long after the George Floyd incident in Minneapolis. And if I read correctly from the Denver Post, that actually Colorado was the first state in the nation to actually end qualified immunity. And so I remember when I worked in the legislature coming into the 2023 session, I remember reading a survey done, and I believe I don't know if it was like the Colorado Fraternal Order of Police or a sheriff's organization. I can't remember exactly who did this survey, but it was across the state of Colorado, different law enforcement agencies. And I remember specifically there were two main issues that department heads and these different law enforcement agencies found that were hurting recruiting and retention. And the top two, number one was like morale and appreciation of police officers was a big one. They felt underappreciated, so that hurt their morale. So that, you know, created a public perception, and it was hard for them to recruit new police officers because people were saying, well, why do I want to, you know, come into this field when we're just under a microscope and being criticized and not being appreciated. But the other top issue was the qualified immunity issue, and the legal liability it opens them up to. I kind of related to my DOD experience when I was in the military. You know, if I don't know if they call it qualified immunity, but basically if you're on duty and there's something happens, a mishap, whether intentional or not, basically the DOD is the one who actually gets sued because I was under their purview and not the individual military member gets sued. So I related to that. I don't know if that's a good comparison or not, but that's what comes to mind when I think of qualified immunity for police officers.
I think that's a pretty good comparison. Because the Board of County Commissioners, and the county itself and those entities are all served with lawsuits for all right. sorts of things that happen in El Paso County, whether right. it's somebody got in a car accident mm-hmm. during a snowstorm or inappropriate or potentially inappropriate behavior on right. the behalf of an employee. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's similar to that. But, you know, you open that up to an individual right. Where even just going through an accusation can be a costly endeavor.
Right. Right.
Putting aside whether or not it's founded or something like that, yeah. I can understand why people would question whether or not the sacrifices is worth it.
Right.
You know, we all carry insurance around. Mm-hmm. With us for driving our vehicles or health insurance or something like that. And it's always the insurance company that gets sued, well, generally. But, you know, if we were always personally liable for everything that happened or were accused of happening, that would get expensive real right. quick. And, of course, that's impacted recruitment.
So thank you for... thank you for clearing that up. I think a lot of people hear the term qualified immunity, but maybe don't exactly know what that means. So that I think that covers it pretty well. Another one there on public safety is truth in sentencing. And so what the Pikes Peak Promise says is ensuring that those convicted of crimes against persons and repeat offenders serve no less than 85% or 75% of their sentences, respectively. And so something that I learned from Michael Fields, actually, from Advance Colorado, is because he's been pushing this issue. If I'm not mistaken, this is a ballot, going to be a ballot-wide issue, the truth in sentencing, is that on average in Colorado, those serving prison time only serve about 43% of their actual sentence. And so what I believe you guys are trying to get at here is you're supporting an effort, whether it's the ballot effort or just actually a bill through the legislature, that people need to serve more of their sentence.
Yeah. And from a Pikes Peak Promise standpoint, we're not picky. Something on the promise is passed through a statewide ballot initiative or through the legislature, we think that's a good thing, because however it gets done, it benefits the people of El Paso County. And with the truth in sentencing, this is actually something that came from our district attorney's office. You know, the people who are on the ground trying to get justice for those that have been wronged. And they saw a direct correlation between the reoffense rate and the amount of time that somebody serves in their sentence, which, I mean, makes sense. And I know that criminal justice reform and everything else is a really complex topic, and we could talk for hours about any of these things. Right. So, but in an attempt to try to boil it down, if somebody doesn't feel like the crime that they committed has any real consequences, then there's no reason not to do it again. Right. And so you're sending the wrong message to one side of the person who's justice involved. But I think you're sending a really confusing message to the other side of the person or the situation where somebody's justice involved, which is the victim. If somebody feels like if their car was stolen or they were mugged or something like that, and it doesn't matter, and society doesn't matter, and then the person is back on the streets and able to do it again, that's a really difficult thing for somebody to internalize. And as somebody who's been a victim of a crime myself, and has been close to a really bad situation where the law was involved, when you feel like the law doesn't work for you, it's hard. You start to question whether society works for you or anything else. And so I think it's important to send that positive message to the victim. And I know that our district attorney feels that way, and he lives and breathes this stuff. And so when he says that this is important to make his job easier and more meaningful and try to balance that scale of justice on both sides, that's important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned recidivism rates. I've read actually very recently that the recidivism rate in Colorado is around 50%, which is the highest in the country. So basically, and that's repeat offenders after getting out of prison within just 3 years of getting out of prison, it's at 50%. Now, I know the Colorado legislature, it was a bipartisan bill they passed actually during the 2023 session, which I thought was a good bill. And it basically, it encourages inmates to seek higher education while they're incarcerated, and actually incentivizes them by, I guess you could say, buying down a little bit of time off their sentence with education, because studies have shown that if you get an associate's degree, the recidivism rate drops dramatically. If you get a bachelor's, it drops even more drastically. And then if you get a master's while you're incarcerated, the recidivism rate is like extremely low. Like I'm talking like 0 or 1%. So I do know the legislature has taken some steps like that for criminal justice reform. And like you said, it's a very complicated issue. But I think most people could agree that if you're not even serving half of the time that you were sentenced to, And then chances are, with the recidivism rates, you very likely may be committing another crime. I think there's definitely some work that needs to be there. And like you said, it's an injustice to the victims, really.
It is. And, you know, to your point too, about the education, I mean, I agree. That's a fantastic, idea. And, you know, with some of these bills, that we're talking about, and some of the ones that have tried to work in the criminal justice area, you know, some of them have been bipartisan, and some of those have had those unintended consequences. And the legislature, I think, has rightfully gone back and, you know, okay, we readdress something that we tried in the past now that we have some data. When a bill only comes from one side of the aisle, you miss an important part of that. And so if you got bipartisan support and you don't quite get it right, just imagine how much more difficult it is to get the policy right if you're only involving one side of the aisle.
Absolutely.
And the state, I think, has done some dynamic things. And if you'll permit a little bit of a tangent,
please.
A previous job, when I worked at the treasurer's office, I sat on the CCI board, which is Colorado Correctionals Incorporated. I think it's been a couple of years, and I get that CCI confused with the county CCI sometimes.
Right.
But it's an incredible program where they will take people who are incarcerated and either teach them basic life skills, like how to use a tape measure, or train them on different industries, so they've got something to look forward to when they get out. And I think that's great, because I think it's important to get justice, and I think it's important for somebody to have opportunity once they get out to create a new life for themselves if they're reformed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should just note that the bipartisan bill I was referring to in 2023 about buying down your time, that's only for nonviolent offenders. So just to clarify that for the audience, so people don't think, well, if you're serving time for murder, if you're serving time for murder, you can just get 10 degrees and knock off 10 years. It doesn't work that way. I think many people would agree, you know, like learning skills and things like that while you're incarcerated. I mean, you're there for that time either way. So it can be productive or it could not be productive. And if, you know, I'm sure there's studies on this, but just common sense says that if you're there and you're serving time and you're learning some kind of skill, even if it's welding or woodworking or anything like that, that the chances, your prospects for getting hired when you get out, are going to increase, especially, you know, if they offer certifications and things like that in those different areas. You get certified in something, you get out, you get a job, because we all know that a lot of those industries are looking for people right now and hurting for workers right now. And so you get employed when you get out and you have this skill, and this ability, the chances of you, getting back into the system and reoffending, I'm sure, probably greatly decreases. So, it's good to see people working on that and the legislature working on that. So unlocking opportunity is our next big priority, and we can get through these pretty quick. So one of the topics on here is address teacher shortages by automatically allowing military spouses licensed to teach in other states to teach in Colorado. I do know in 2023, I believe the sponsor, I could be wrong about this. I believe it was Representative Don Wilson. I could be wrong about that. I know he was on the education committee and he was working on this in 2023, but it was more of a it was more of like a pact with other states to come together and make the licensing like cross state lines easier for teachers, because you know, Colorado has its requirements, other states have their requirements, and this was just something to try to make the pipeline easier and get you through quicker. And I imagine that's probably what you guys are aiming at, something similar, but it looks like it pertains specifically for like military spouses.
Right. Yeah. And of course, El Paso County is a home to 100,000 either active duty, retired, or dependent people right. associate with the military. And so anything that helps those families is near and dear to our hearts. Yeah. I know most of our board is connected to the military in some form mm-hmm. or another. Either they served or their spouse served. Right. I'm an Army brat. Yeah. And so, you know, when you're in a community like El Paso County in Colorado Springs, you really see what life is like for somebody in the military. Right. And for some of these folks, they didn't choose to have to come here, but right. They had a life established in another state. Them or their spouse was assigned here, and either they retire, they're trying to enter the civilian workforce. And there are these barriers that exist. And I get it. You know, there's standards for teaching and a whole host of other things for a reason. And Colorado is in a compact currently, but I think that it can be expanded. I think that we can do more. And actually, the legislature this session has 5 or 6 different compact bills that address different industries, and we're totally in favor of that.
Good.
I think that's a good proactive step that the legislature is taking to look at these industries and see what makes sense. And especially in the industries where, to your point earlier, we have a shortage for some of these folks.
Right.
You know, you've gone through it. You've gone through a process somewhere else. Now you're here, you're supporting your spouse, or you've got these skill sets, you're trying to enter the workforce. I say, come on in. We need you. So
yeah,
please.
And you know, military life, you know, the thing with it is, especially depending on, you know, if you're a military spouse, depending on your, the active members, you know, whether they're an officer or enlisted or what their job specifically is, a lot of times you only go to a new base and you're only there for like 2 years and then you're moving again. I know the officer corps, they move about every 2 years, normally from what I saw, when I was in. And so, you know, if, you know, there's like a 6-month process or something like that to try to get your license. Well, you know, that's going to be very hard for that spouse who is a teacher, because you move somewhere, by the time you get settled in and, you know, you get everything in order, and then you start going through the process of getting the certification for Colorado, but maybe you have a certification in 2 or 3 other states, but you have to do Colorado's. And if it's not efficient, well, you just lost 6 months out of that 2 years there. And then by the time you get hired and everything, and then it's like, okay, well now maybe you can teach for 1 year. So I think anything that expedites that process so you can get in there quicker, would be a good thing. And you have to imagine, you know, if you're a teacher in wherever, Florida or California or Oklahoma or anywhere, you know, the idea that it's so drastically different from being a teacher in a different state, I just kind of doesn't make sense to me. So it would make more sense to make it as efficient as possible. You know, because I don't think there's going to be that big of a gap, whether you're a teacher in a different state and then you come to Colorado. I could be wrong about that. I'm not a teacher, but
yeah. And, you know, admittedly that's not my area of expertise, right. But I think about it too, from like a fairness and equity perspective for right. that family. Cause if it, to your example, if it does take 6 months, if you are a 2-income family in Oklahoma or California or something,
yeah.
And we know that the cost of living in Colorado is going up,
right.
and you want to be able to help provide for your family, but you don't have the opportunity to do that for 6 months or something like that, that can have a big impact on a family. I mean, if you lost 30 or 40% of your household income right now, that'd
right.
be tough. And that
exactly.
would, you're losing out on a skilled person who wants to do good and serve the community in another way. And
right.
you're impacting them on a personal level. It just seems like the right thing and the fair thing to do, to let them serve.
Absolutely. Okay. So I know we're running over about 30 minutes right now. So I'm going to skip ahead and just cover one last quick thing. No, it's
sure.
okay. No, it's my fault. So let's get to the last priority, and let's talk about Institute Senior Property Tax Exemption Portability.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a whole lot of words, a lot of syllables. if you can kind of dumb that down for me, I would really appreciate that. What are we looking at accomplishing here with that, the portability aspect?
So in Colorado, if you meet certain criteria, you get a property tax exemption if you're old enough to qualify. And that extends to some other aspects of our community as well. But one of the, one of the criteria is that you have to live in the property for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. But if you leave that property, you move and buy another house, you lose that tax exemption. The clock resets and you have to be in that property for the amount of time to qualify for it.
Right.
And we think that that's a problem. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at the demographic that typically uses that, they're older, they may be mm-hmm. in a bigger house, but they're empty nesters. Right. But if we're making somebody stay in their house because they want the property tax break, but if they left that house, that would free up housing for a new family that's moving into the state or somebody who's growing their family or something else. It makes sense. And it, again, seems fair to let them take that property tax deduction with them when they move to the new place. We think that helps people size into the house that's right for them, that opens up other things for the market and treats that senior with respect. If they've already qualified for it once, they should be able to carry it with them.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. And if I'm not mistaken, I read that it was like 10 years. They have to live in that house to get that exemption. And so if you're thinking, well, you know, you have a 65-year-old couple and maybe they have that exemption, but like you said, they want to downsize, they're empty nesters now. And now they're looking at, well, if we sell this house and we downsize and make this house available for, like you said, a growing family who needs those extra bedrooms and things like that. Now if that senior couple moves somewhere, if I understand it correctly, then they would have to wait another 10 years to get that exemption. Yeah. And so now I'm using the lowest range at 65, but you know, what if they're 75 and then you're telling them, okay, well, when you're 85, you can get this tax exemption, when we know that they're going to be on a fixed income most likely and things like that. And so that tax exemption actually means a lot, especially when you look at, rising rates and everything.
And 10 years without that exemption, that's a long time.
It's a long time. It's a very long time.
It's a long time to qualify for it, but it's a long time to re-qualify for it.
Right, exactly.
And I can't think of another tax exemption. I might just not be imaginative enough, mm-hmm. But you know, you deduct your children or something like that.
Right.
It's not like you have to wait a certain period of time or they have to re-qualify as a child every couple of years or something until they're 18.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
It seems like the right thing to do to show respect for our seniors. Mm-hmm. And again, if you look at this, we're showing that people are valued here, whether it's the military family or the family that's already here or somebody else that wants economic opportunity or seniors. Mm-hmm. This is about showing that we value these people. We love what they contribute to our state and we want to make life better for them.
Absolutely. Well, Ryan, I think I know you have a meeting coming up here, so I'm going to respect your time. I could probably talk to you for another couple hours about these issues.
Yeah. And sorry if I was long-winded about something.
I'm used
to radio, so when you said don't treat it like radio, like,
right.
Oh my gosh, I can talk forever.
Yeah, on radio you have to talk in like 20-second little spurts and answers, and you always have to be conscious of commercial breaks and things like that. So maybe we can have you back on in the future to talk about some other things that are in Pikes Peak Promise, or maybe an update down the road on, okay, so have we gotten anywhere with this? You know, has the legislature passed any bills? Have we made any improvements on that? So I think that'd be a good idea for a later topic.
Yeah, but, I'd love to, because there's a lot going on. I mean, this is just, you know, where we've come to areas of agreement. But if we were talking about things that were impacting the county or citizens, there's a lot that we could cover.
Absolutely. Ryan, I want to say thank you again, and thank you for all the work you guys do at the county government level. And you know, we look forward to seeing what kind of progress gets made on this in the future.
Yeah, thank you for your interest, and appreciate you having me on, and appreciate what you're doing here too.
Thank you very much, Ryan. We'll see you later.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the Engage the Rockies podcast, your go-to podcast for local and state issues concerning Colorado.